So everyone who's got addictive personality has a chance of building an empire, a multi-million dollar company, every single one of them. I don't care if you're sat in the gutter right now, that's the kind of brain you have.
From the moment you wake up to the moment your head hits the pillow, this is the It's All Day podcast. Your home for knowledge and inspiration about fitness, nutrition, and the mentality behind what it takes to be great. What is up, guys? Welcome to another episode of the It's All Day podcast. Today, I am here with Dr. Rob Kelly. Dr. Rob Kelly has a PhD, is a sought-after recovery expert who believes in treating the causes of addiction and not the symptoms. He's currently the CEO of the Rob Kelly Recovery Group, an addiction and mental illness recovery coaching company he created based on extensive research and behavior studies that he's been doing over the last 20 years. And he also has a book called Daddy, Daddy, Please Stop Drinking, where he shares his personal highs and lows of his own addiction and recovery. And now he gets to help people never have to go through the things that he went through. So, Dr. Rob Kelly, thank you for coming on the show, man.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here. It's going to be a good show.
Yeah, man. Very excited. If you don't mind, I would love for you to maybe start by taking us back to maybe pre-addiction days. I'm just kind of curious as to, were there any catalysts that potentially started the downturn for you, or what was that story like?
Well, when I look back now and look at the research that we've done personally, and I don't think there's any other doctor as researched and specialized in alcoholism, not addiction, alcoholism as me. So when I look back, I took my first drink at the age of 19, my age of nine, on a stage in a musical family in Liverpool, England. And that's where I first took my first drink. So that started it all. It's just a matter of time before you cross the line. But yeah, I was drinking every weekend and, you know, went through school and stuff. Everything was good. For a long time, alcohol was good to me, you know. And I don't think there's one defining moment after the 9 years old, which wasn't a defining moment then, that said, oh, my God, I'm in trouble. Because even when I was homeless, I think I was in trouble. I just thought I was going through some, you know, bad luck and it'll change soon.
Yeah,
that's the kind of stuff that the alcoholism does, and addiction, is it creeps up on you, and everybody knows you're suffering apart from you, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was, because I heard in different interviews you saying that you were a functioning addict functioning alcoholic for 10 years.
Yeah.
What did, you know, quote unquote, functioning alcoholic look like?
Well, for anybody that doesn't know what blackout is, because a lot of people think blackout is when you go unconscious. An alcoholic blackout is when you can perform at a high level and people don't know you're drunk. But for you, you don't remember the day before. For me, I don't remember the month before. I would go in blackouts for weeks and months. I'd be drunk every single day. So a blackout is not remembering what you did the previous day. That's the easiest way to put it.
Yeah.
So when you start having blackouts, you know you're in serious trouble.
Yeah. When you... So were there any times when you first started coming out of those blackouts that, you know, you had the conversation with yourself like, whoa, like, you know, it's been the last month, I don't remember, the last week, I don't remember, time to start really looking at this? Or was this just something that if it happened, you didn't really look at it, you just kept going?
I kept going because, I mean, it was just, that was my upbringing. So when any sort of addiction, you've got to look back at the trauma and you've got to look back at learned behavior and enmeshment from parents.
Yeah.
Learned behavior was everybody drank in the family. I was supposed to grow up, have a few drinks at weekend. Mine was every day. But there was alcoholism in my family. So I didn't know any better but to go and drink. But no, it crept up and crept up and crept up. And, you know, the earlier the drink got, you know, I used to get home at five. I'm going to drink at five and that's it. And that worked for a couple of weeks. And then before I know what day it was, I'm drinking 24 hours a day. I'm starting the day off at 6 a.m. getting up with vodka. And I'm finishing, well, I'm passing out at 9 or 10 o'clock at night time through vodka.
Wow. Crazy. That is something I've definitely never had to experience myself. What was, like, when did it start to spiral? You said that you were a functioning alcoholic for 10 years. At what point did it stop becoming a functioning thing?
I think it stopped becoming about 84, 85 when I was working. I kind of knew that I was ranting and raving at work, being very loud and aggressive and arguing with people. And the next day when I got up, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. That's where I first realized that, you know, it might be good if I didn't drink at work, but again, just I couldn't stop. Yeah, and most people look back and they go, hey, alcohol, you can stop anytime you want. Alcoholics are born, drug addicts are made, okay? It's a scientific biochemical reaction that I have to alcohol. Well, it's actually the ethanol in alcohol. It's a predisposition, so it's passed down from generation to generation. So when someone says, oh, I'm an alcoholic, well, if you've got no generational alcoholism in the lineage of your family, you might not be. You might somebody who abuses alcohol. But there's a huge difference with in the brain between a non-alcoholic and an alcoholic. There's three parts of the brain that act differently from birth. We're born this way, you know, that people don't understand. When I ask somebody, a layman, you know, what's an alcoholic, they'll say somebody who drinks too much alcohol, or it's somebody that abuses alcohol. None of them are correct. Alcohol has 1% to do with alcoholism, and the same with drugs and any other crazy addiction. It's not the drinking problem I had. I had a thinking problem. Everything was internal for me. The way I thought, the way I hear is different to anybody else. Alcoholics hear things different from birth and hear aggressiveness because they're always on. The basal ganglia is our repetition, strength, and confirmed part of the brain. Mine was broken around 10 to the hour. And the broken was self-sabotage. I'd go into that self-sabotage motive. And for me, that was alcohol. So unless you clear them three up, you are destined either to get help or get locked up for life or death.
Interesting. So what are those three components of the brain? So you have the basal ganglia. What were the other two components that an alcoholic is born with that's different?
Well, the hypothalamus and, of course, the amygdala. It's like our smoke alarm for the brain. And I'll tell you how it works. The basal ganglia, it's a repetition, like I said. And we go, get the car back, everything's good, get the wife back, amazing, good at work, and bang, we self-sabotage for no reason at all. Ask any alcoholic why a relapse, he'll give you 1,000 excuses, but not one reason, because the brain's telling them. And here's the real interesting part. This is why it's not only called a disease, but it's not our fault, it's hereditary, is the hypothalamus. It's our fight or flight part of the brain attached to the amygdala. The hypothalamus tells normal people to drink water, eat food, to run or to hide. That's what its main function is. And it tells everyone to do it, even me at the beginning. But what happens with the alcoholic, we're born, not made, is at a certain time of our career of drinking, it switches over and it tells the alcoholic to drink alcohol. That's why I can go days, weeks, even months without eating food or drinking water. The hypothalamus is telling me, my fight or flight is telling me to drink alcohol. And again, the amygdala, which is our smoke alarm, it's all kind of connected to that as well. So they're the three things that are different in alcoholic brains than they are in normal brains. People don't have that. Mm-hmm. When normal people take a drink, they don't go the next morning, go, I need another drink. They go, oh, it was a great last night, or I blacked out last night and get back to work. You know, hypothalamus is telling me to drink alcohol 24 hours a day. And I can't stop because now my brain's telling me, how can I change the way I think? You can't. Mm-hmm. With deep therapy, trauma therapy, rewiring the brain, that's what I do. Neuroplasticity. And if you don't do that, you're always destined to relapse and die.
Wow. Super interesting. Very, very cool. When you went through this process and you started spiraling, what was rock bottom?
Rock bottom with me was a couple of things that led up for that. Let me share that because then you'll emphasize the rock bottom. Is I came down from the bedroom for 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I wanted a drink and I knew I had vodka somewhere in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So as I came down, I looked through the kitchen and I found the bottle of vodka. I took it out, I placed it on the counter and I went to the cupboard and I got a crystal glass because, hey, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not drinking from the bottle because that's what I thought an alcoholic was. And as I turned around, my wife had followed me downstairs and she snatched the bottle of vodka off the side and she said, I think you've had enough. What I should have done and any normal would have done, thank you, Mrs. Kelly. I'll go back to bed in a few more hours. What I did was took a kitchen knife out and stabbed her 3 times. I took the bottle off her. I finished the bottle and she was bleeding, obviously. I called the police and I called a taxi. The taxi listener just around the corner came first. I waited till I hear a sirens and I fled to Spain. I wouldn't come back until 3 months later until all charges were dropped. because it didn't do any internal damage. She was out of hospital in 3 days. And then I came back. When I got home, she had the suitcases and my daughters, ages 1 and 3, ready to go. And she went to her mom's. And I got them back the next day from my attorney. I sat them in front of the TV. I knew I had this huge responsibility. I went into the kitchen. I opened the fridge. I got one beer out and I heard opening the beer. 3 days later, when the police kicked the door down, because I'm in stupidity blackout, the children have not been fed or changed diapers for 2 days. They grabbed them off. They kicked me awake and he handed me with a paper saying unfit father. We walked to the door. The police was there. The authorities were there. The child protection, the child services, the mom, my wife. And they took my babies, one of them grabbed the youngest, one of two. And then the eldest, 3 or 4, was holding our mummy's hand as she's walking away from the house down the path. And she said 3 things to me. She said, "Daddy, daddy, please don't go. Daddy, daddy, please get better." And as she got to the gate and opened the gate, she says, "Daddy, daddy, please stop drinking." That right there crushed me, absolutely. About 3 or 4 weeks later, the house had gone, the cars had gone, the wife had gone, the kids had gone. Mom threw me out, friends threw me out, and I landed on the streets of Manchester in the UK, pouring with rain, freezing, going, saying to myself, "Where the fuck did that just go wrong?"
Wow. Heavy. Very heavy.
Yeah.
That's as rock bottom as I think you can potentially get. And what's crazy is I think you ended up staying homeless on the streets for a couple of years, right?
14 months to be exact. So a year and a bit. Mm-hmm.
And what was that? Was that like your, not confession, when you go to church and you have to do all your prayers afterwards?
Yeah. my homelessness at the time was like being in hell. I had to fight every day, and I don't mean shout. I mean, use my fist every day to stay alive. I bare-knuckled fighting with the gypsies to earn money. If I didn't earn money, I would steal it. And here's a quick scenario, the place I was in. I have this bench I go to sleep on every night, and the guy came up and said, "Can you sleep next to me?" I said, "Sure." Woke up the next morning, he'd been stabbed to death for his sneakers. Somebody stole his sneakers. I woke up and he was dead next to me. That's the kind of environment I was in. I never really slept properly for 14 months. But I came from the project, you know, and I knew how to handle myself. And to be honest, Chris, I got to tell you that after about 8 or 9 months, it got quite comfortable. Really? Because I had no cares, no worries, just got drunk every day, passed out, stole more alcohol, and continued that cycle.
Wow. See, I know when I, my freshman year of college, I got in trouble. Almost got a DUI, probably should have gotten a DUI, was drinking, got pulled over, got away with possession of alcohol under 21. But some of the things I had to do because of my court order mandate was I had to go to AA meetings and I had to go to NA meetings. And I remember when I went to AA meetings, I was still extremely egotistical at this time when I was about 18, 19. So when I first got pulled over and all this stuff happened, I actually still blamed the cop.
Yeah.
I said, "This is her fault. I was in a drive-through. I wasn't actually even driving. Shouldn't be here." And all the AA meetings, didn't really care. Just did what I had to do. I went to the NA meetings, and NA's Narcotics Anonymous. Don't really know why I had to go, but I was there. And I'm telling my same story. I was in a drive-through McDonald's. This is stupid. I'm 18 in college. Just made a mistake. Guy next to me says, "Hey, my name's Dan. I'm addicted to ketamine. Keep doing K-holes every single day and I can't stop." And I remember as an 18-year-old kid who pretty much grew up, you know, pretty middle class, not really rough and tough, my entire ego the entire time kept saying, "It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault." Once I found out that I was sitting next to a man who's addicted to ketamine and couldn't stop,
yeah,
it was my wake-up call. I remember I was in the room and I go, "Chris, what the fuck are you doing? Yeah. Why are you here? Like, you're a good kid. You're in school for football. You play soccer. You get good grades. You shouldn't be here. Like, you need to accept that this is your fault. You need to get the heck out of here." And so I'm curious, if you were on the streets for 8 months, you were still feeling comfortable despite all of these things. At what point did the wake up call happen that really made you realize, like, I need to get the heck out of here. I need to start changing my life around.
it was involuntary and it was unexpected. But one night, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I've run out of alcohol. I'm walking near the factories downtown, so nobody's there, it's desolate. And it was pouring down in rain, and I was crying from my stomach because I don't know. I was just so emotional. I dropped down to my hands and knees and I sobbed. The thought crossed my mind that I wasn't sobbing because of my children or my wife or my money, cars, houses. I was sobbing because the first time I realized I couldn't stop drinking. And it took all of that. And I remember looking up to the sky, and I didn't believe in God. But I did say, if there's a God up there, I can't do this on my own anymore. And about 30 seconds later, this guy walked past me. He'd missed his last bus home from a Bible study, of all things. And he was taking a quick way through around town to get to his house. He came up to me and said, do you want help? I said, yes. I went back to his house, and that's where my journey started. And it was the weirdest thing. And there's another weird thing later on we can go into, but his name was John. But the problem with staying at Derek's house was, he said, you can stay here for as long as you want, but you've got to come to these 12-step meetings. I hated them meetings. I used to beat people up and hit them with chairs in them meetings. I knew I wasn't very good at them meetings. I hated all the pissing and moaning, the war stories. But I had to go because it was a bed for the night or forever, a dry bed, you know. I was showered for the first time in 9 months and got some new clothes and the first time in 14 months. And I went to this meeting with him, and sure enough, the piss and moaning started, and I'm bored out of my head thinking, how can I get out of here without Derek knowing? And then this guy shared, I always remember it, his name was John. He said, my name's John, I'm a recovered alcoholic. And all of a sudden, he's like, somebody hit me with a frying pan. It's like, what did he just say? And he talked from that book they have, and he talked about God, and he talked about, and everything he related to, he'd open a page of the book and he'd point to it. I'd read that book thousands of times. So when he finished, I walked up and said, hey, John, my name's Rob, will you sponsor me? And he goes, no. So just before I wanted the earth to open and swallow me, he said, I will be your spiritual advisor for a period of 12 weeks, which I thought was weird, but he had me go out to his house every Wednesday. I think it was 7 o'clock I had to be there. So I walked for an hour from Derek's house to this guy's apartment, spent an hour with him and walked back home. So 6 till 9 every Wednesday for 12 weeks. When I walked out of that man's apartment, I knew if I carried on doing what I'm supposed to do, I'd never drink again. And he told me your life would get better and better and better, which I argued because I'm in this guy's basement on a blow-up mattress. Nobody knew I'm there, but he said, my circumstances will change from tomorrow. So I went back home, went to bed. I got up. Derek had gone to work already. He used to work in a factory. And at 11 o'clock, the door opened. And there was Derek. And I'm like, what are you doing here? It's 11 o'clock. He said, Rob, there's a part-time job going sweeping the floor at the factory. Do you want it? I'm like, yeah, I want it. So I went back to work. I spent the afternoon sweeping up after everybody. And that next day, that turned into a full-time job because I had everybody laughing and they loved me and stuff like that. So after 2 weeks, I went to the garage gas station and I bought him a little teddy bear and I bought him a card. And I wrote on the card, thank you, John, blah, 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 you're best in the world or something. Thank you for introducing me to God. And I walked back to his house. And when I got to his apartment, there was nobody there. So I was knocking on the door and a girl from the right-hand side apartment came out and says, can I help you? And I said, yeah, can you tell me where John's moved to? It looks empty. And she said, there's been no one in that apartment for the 3 months I've been here. You must have the wrong apartment. So I let her close the door. I'm thinking, okay, she's crazy. And I knocked on the left-hand side door and a guy came to the door and said, can you tell me where John's relocated to? And he said, and I quote, there's been no one in that apartment for a year. That apartment is derelict. You can't go in it. It's too dangerous. So I'm now confused. So I went back to the meeting where I met this John and I said to the chairman, you remember me? He said, oh, I remember you, Rob. Is it Rob? I said, yeah, about 12 weeks, 13 weeks ago. Yeah, I remember you, man. How are you doing? I said, I'm doing good, but I'm trying to chase this John that I met here. He said, John? I said, yeah, I kind of met him. He said he's recovered and stuff. Walked over to the coffee machine and we're chatting away and he looked at me puzzled. And I said, what's wrong? He said, Rob, you was over near the coffee machine speaking to yourself. Never found that man. Wow. Never found him. We tried every way to find him, to thank him. Couldn't find him. But the program, my program today, that was at almost 100% success rate, 90% come from him. Everyone else has a 4 to 5 success rate. Anybody out there, treatment centers, doctors, anybody. 10% is the most we've found, and they haven't got records like us going back 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
We have a 98% success rate. It's not really me.
Yeah.
It must be some sort of higher power as an influence or energy or universe or something. So that's why I do what I do today. It's like, I got out. Let me show you how to get out.
Yeah. That's incredible, man.
Yes. I won't tell that story, Chris, for 10 years. Maybe
no
15
way.
Years. I won't say it because I, you know, before the internet and everything, if I told somebody, they'd call me crazy. But
yeah,
I opened up one day on a broadcast. I think it was on live TV or something. There was 18 million viewers listening, and I opened up and told them about that, and everybody just thought it was amazing. So I started telling the story.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say when people come to you, you talk about like not accepting them, the people who aren't ready. Do you think that somehow, in some sense, when you were in those groups, the day you decided that you were ready is when John appeared?
I think so. I mean, it took what it took. I work with people today. I work with a lot of famous people, a lot of very affluent people. That's our target, though we do 25% pro bono, so we fit everybody in. And, you know, you're ready when you're ready. If you come to me and you're not ready, I'm not going to accept you. I turned down Britney Spears in Dallas for $1 million. Jamie, her father, offered me $1 million. She was drunk. She just finished a concert and said, I can't do it. And I always swore to that. That's what I would never do this for the money.
Mm-hmm.
I would always do it for the right reason. And I'll go to any lens to find out if you're ready. I will get you followed. I will mic your car up. I will do anything to find out if you're playing the game or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm very adamant with stuff like, we're very proud that we've built a company on truthfulness, which is nothing like I used to live. Yeah. All my life was a lie.
Is that what so much of addiction really comes down to?
Addiction comes down to a couple of things. Drug addiction comes down to taking something over and over and over again, and you having the addictive personality. That's how you get addicted, okay? Most people, if not all people, come to us with a heroin addict, started in the doctor's office with pain meds. End of story.
Mm-hmm.
We've worked with over 8,000 people now, so we know what we're talking about. Alcoholism is different. Like I said, we're born this way. As soon as you take the first drink, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are alcoholics that never take a drink. They're the guys running Google and Amazon. Okay, they're the smartest guys in the room because that's what the alcoholic brain is. It's a very, very smart brain. Neural pathways are built differently, and three parts of the brain are built differently. But trauma is the gateway drug.
Mm.
If you have an addiction problem of any kind, you've suffered childhood trauma. You can't be an alcoholic, addict, food, sex, case, porn. You can't get addicted to them without having childhood trauma. Everybody does. Most normal people do.
Yeah.
But then when you say that, because I never got through any trauma. I wasn't in a plane crash. I wasn't. You've got to define the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Anything less than nurturing pertaining to alcoholics is child abuse.
Yeah.
End of story. There's different parts of our brain that are numbing when we come to that. Always on that, the fight or flight. Everything we hear is a threat. We're under that threat all the time, nervous in the stomach all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I still, if my wife needs to hammer something or do something in their house, like chop a huge potato, she'll warn me. I'm going to make a noise and she'll smash it. This is 30-odd years on because I can't change that part of my brain. You see, we're born with two fears as a baby. Yeah, we're born with falling. We're scared of falling and we're scared of loud noises. They're the only two fears that a human being is born with. And after a period of time, two things that we're born with, okay, disappear. Mm-hmm. So how do we get fear and trauma? It's passed down from generation. It's our caregivers that introduce fear to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's our caregivers that introduce trauma to us and put us through trauma through no fault of their own.
Correct.
Like I was always dropped off at my friends, my mom's dad's friends. So for overnight, Friday night, as soon as they disappeared, there was a man and woman, and we had to play run around naked, it was called. And we all had to take our clothes off and run around the house. That was child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't tell my mom and dad that, but that was child abuse. I had problems in my relationships getting undressed. Even when I was a champion British bodybuilder that won titles, I hated taking my shirt off because of that trauma. And that took me years to put together. And that's what people don't understand, is what you're going through now is connected to your childhood trauma. Mm-hmm. Everything. I'm having problems with women. I can't get that job. Whatever it is, it's connected to what somebody said in the past that's affected you.
Yeah, there's a great book that I read. It was called Adult Children Emotionally Immature Parents.
Yeah.
That was recommended to me. And it was one of the greatest books that I was able to read to kind of recognize and understand that these traumas that we did have passed down from our parents, you know, at some level, they're doing the best they can based on what they were raised with by their own parents. And as you go back in time and you see, you know, the war and, you know, my dad's side's all in the Navy. So my grandpa was in the Navy. My dad was in the Navy. My great grandpa was in the Navy. And that militant type yes. of personality passed down generation by generation really taught men on my side of the family that you don't show emotions. And if you got a problem, you drink alcohol.
Oh my God. That is mind blowing. No, because people say that my generation, fathers and grandfathers, they dropped the ball. Maybe it's what they went through.
Correct.
That they taught us, and then we teach our children. And it goes. I was lucky to break the mold, but wow, I'm going to use that in future. That's okay. I love that. Of course they did.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Because when I come from, it's stiff upper lip.
Yeah. You coming from the UK, of course.
Yeah.
You know, the UK, that's all it's about. It's, you know, if you got a problem, you drink alcohol. And your parents learned that, and their grandparents learned that.
Yeah.
And as I've gotten older, I remember I went through therapy and I would resent my parents a lot for the lack of love and nurturing that I really got. But as I started to look back and really understand what they were going through at the time when they were raising me, if you can look at that from a broader perspective, you can have a little bit more empathy towards the people that raise you. And that yes. can help you kind of accept what's going on with you versus holding this resentment, which is really keeping you stuck in this place that you're in right now.
You know, I often say when we're talking about trauma with patients, it's not mom and dad's fault. Mm-hmm. I always say that it's not mom and dad's fault, but you know, something's happened to you. Now you can break the mold because there's no directions or handbook with children. Here's how to raise a child. Here's how to not damage him. We did not, it only last 5 to 10 years we found out our trauma, you know, in the depth that we have. So they didn't know they were traumatizing us. But I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, Chris. I'm gonna note that.
Of course. Yeah, I'm glad. Okay. I'm curious, as you've, you know, helped people and gone through this yourself, you know, you talk a lot about it's thoughts in our brain and these repeating things. So how obviously important is the self-talk, and what can some people do to, I think, first just become aware of the self-talk before they start to try and do anything about it?
That's a great question as well. I fucking love you already. Awesome. The internal dialogue is what gets us every time. You know, you go for a job and inside, I'm not good enough. I don't think I'll get it. You talk yourself out of it before you even get there.
Mm-hmm.
What we speak, even if you're joking, you should never put yourself down, and you should never allow anybody else to do it, even in jest. When people are joking about it, they really mean it. And my being as a whole will take hold of that. So self-sabotaging thoughts. Then let's talk about the normal person. Self-sabotaging thoughts. You go with a rubber band. If you're listening abroad in England, so it's elastic band, get it around your wrist. And whenever you have one of them thoughts, you snap it, snap the band, and it will redirect neural pathways. Our golden number is 7.3 seconds. When a bad thought or a bad talk in your head, you know, the internal dialogue starts, you have around 7.3 seconds to redirect neural pathways, and you do it with a snap of a band. That's all it is. The second is if you have addiction or gone through trauma as a kid or been molested, or if you was in a home or something, your subconscious is filled with negative talk from people that's been talking to you, caregiving, looking after you, all that stuff. So you have to reload the subconscious brain. And the way you do it is get up in the morning, make sure you got your elastic band on for the day, walk to the bathroom mirror, look in the mirror face to face, so you're looking at yourself, can be a bit awkward for those guys in addiction, and say, I love you 10 times. You're not going to feel anything. It's going to feel stupid. You don't think it's, oh, it's okay, but don't do it this morning. If you do that, I guarantee you that when you go for that job, that girl, that wife, that house, that car, you'll get it. Because from the subconscious mind doesn't go, uh-oh, oh my God, look at him, he's dressed better than me. Yeah, I used to walk into a room, Chris, as a suffering alcoholic bodybuilder, huge, was scared of crap out of anybody. I used to walk in rooms with my head down, and I used to wonder who liked me. Since I've done the work on myself, I almost kick the door down now, not a bodybuilder, a lot thinner, walk in and go, who the fuck do I like in here? That's the difference. It's not ego, yeah. You know? Ego is wanting me to know you, I can do something. Confidence is me knowing I can do something.
Yeah,
that's all it is. Everybody listening to this, and believe me, I have two messages. First of all, you have not got time. I went to bed last night, I was 19. I woke up today, I'm 61. You do not have time. If you want to start that business, date that girl, buy that car, do it now. You don't have time. Please, please remember this. Please, I'm an old guy who's done everything. You know, mm-hmm. You just don't have time. And the second one is, if you're sat at home now and you're thinking you're never good enough, you're never going to amount to anything, your life's never going to change, I want to apologize to you. Because somebody's put that there. We are born with million-dollar minds. Why are you hanging around 10-cent minds? Mm. That's the question you have to ask yourself. Show me your friends. I'll show you your future. You know, because what happens when I was a kid playing football in the street? Jimmy, what do you want to be when you grow up? I'll be an astronaut. What about you, Rob? I want to be a footballer. What happened to them dreams? I'll tell you. Your family and friends kicked it out of you. That's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Don't put the imagination... don't put your imagination on hold. Stop putting the brakes on your imagination. You can do anything you want, and it's all down to learned behavior, whether it's caregivers or not. So to emphasize this point, we stuck 1,000 fleas into a huge jar, mm-hmm. huge mason jar. If you're listening abroad, like a huge jam jar. We put 1,000 fleas, we punctured the top. Now, fleas can jump 3 or 4 feet,
yep.
as we know. We left the lid on for 3 days only. We took the lid off, we screwed it off, and we put it on the side. Not one flea jumped higher than there where the lid was, okay, first of all.
Love it.
That's interesting, right? When they had babies inside the jar, the babies wouldn't jump higher than where the lid was. They didn't even see the lid. And that's passed down learned behavior. Is you can do anything you want to do once you get your trauma sorted out. You can do anything. Well, I can't be president of the United States, really? Forget your political views for a second. We had a business and running the country. You can do anything that you want to do. I dare you to go out and do it, guys.
Love it, man. I love these messages. A curious thing I did have to ask you is when you talked about having an addictive personality, do you think it's a good idea to identify as having an addictive personality or not? Because I'm somebody who actually does. I tell people all the time I have an addictive personality. I've just found ways to make that addictive personality beneficial towards my life with better substitutes. But I don't know if that's like a literal thing or if it's just a terminology that people label themselves on.
Yeah, I've heard terminology like that, but I've also know that if you have an addictive personality, it's all about perception of what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone who's got addictive personality has a chance of building an empire, a multi-million dollar company, every single one of them. I don't care if you're sat in the gutter right now, that's the kind of brain you have. But again, neural pathways, self-sabotaging neural pathways outweigh good neural pathways with a lot of us. So it takes us down the opposite route. So then that perception becomes
interesting. Okay.
You know, it's like the alcoholic that had two kids. This is a true story. He was alcoholic, he lost his job, but he had two children, wife divorced him. One child grew up to owning a multi-million dollar company, and the other one ended up a drunk in the streets. It's about perspective. What do you want to do and how bad do you want it? That's mm-hmm. what it all comes down to. Then once you know your addictive personality, you're not out there taking drugs, hurting people. What you're doing is you're turning it to business. You turn it to benefit other people. I mean, that's just a fantastic way to live. This has never been about the money for us. We're a multi-million dollar company, but it's never been about the money. It's all about giving back. You know, where can we treat somebody free? You know, that addiction of mine of still wanting to help people all the time is a healthy one, just like yours is. But I think once you know that, you can definitely put it to your advantage, because if you don't realize that and don't do your homework on that, that could destroy you. So knowledge is powerful in any game.
Yeah. What do you think the ratio, especially in your work, because you guys definitely have the numbers on this, what's the ratio of men to women when it comes to struggling with addiction?
70% men, 30% women.
Do you guys know, or do you guys do research onto why it's more men than it is women?
God, there's loads of ways. I mean, first of all, the man's at work, the woman's got all day, and if she's working, it's out with friends, it's mommy juice when they got kids. I mean, it's all this stuff of watching learned behavior as well. You know, it's most likely, and I don't know the complete numbers in this because we haven't studied the genes, but it looks like, from what we've done over 30 years, it looks like most of the alcoholic genes are passed to male and not female. So 70% to male and female. And okay, guys, okay, I'm sorry about this, but the female are more astute than we are, unfortunately. You know, so I think there's also that to play in it, but I don't have a permanent guaranteed answer for you, but that's what it looks like to me.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that right now, especially, do you think it's become easier, more common for men to go towards these addictive type of coping mechanisms as our society seems to be caring a little bit less and less about men and more about women and their rise? And as they've risen, it's kind of been that the men have been thrown in the shadows. And as the men have been thrown in the shadows, it seems that because of, you know, generations of behaviors, it's just led to more and more men going towards these addictions.
Okay, we got to start a show together, Chris. Great question. It's like, this is awesome for me. Wow. I think that men started to come out. Men are, let's say 5 years ago, men were there like the gay population was in the 80s. They were just starting to come out and people just starting to trust them, and it was normal. And men started seeking treatment. Then the Me Too movement came out. Nothing wrong with that. It was great. Yeah. Men stepped back straight away and they went back into that, you know, stiff upper lip kind of mentality. And what's interesting is when the men come to us, it's always the wives that call us. It's never the guys. You go, hey, I have a problem. She's the wife's going, oh, my husband got a problem and he won't admit it. Or he don't know what to do or whatever. So yeah, played a big part, a huge part in that. What a great question.
Yeah, because it's something that I've just been thinking of more and more, because it seems society is trying to help bolster the women in
the women's movement,
give them more jobs. You know, you look now, you see more and more women going to college, less and less men going to college. As women get more and more powerful in society, these ideas and these concepts that, you know, women don't need no man. I can do everything on my own. I can make the money. I can raise the kid. I can be a single mom. And these men get kind of left out to dry in these types of relationships. And if you decide to start showing emotion, society will also tell us all that a man can't cry, that a guy can't cry. If he's crying, then he's weak. So now he's stuck and he has nowhere to go.
Yeah, 100%. I love that. And by the way, good to you, women. All power to you when you're doing that. It's not your fault. You know, all the stuff we're doing now and the power, girl power and all that stuff is amazing. But, you know, look out for your male friends, look out for your husband, watch for traits, watch if less worthy than anybody else, watch for head down when he walks into a room, you know, boosting up with the confidence that men used to do to women. Women start doing it to men because we can't be left out to the dry. You know, I was in the Dallas office, and there was two nurses on that day, and a guy walked in suicidal, and the nurse brought him in and sat him down in my office. And an hour later, he went out, he was whistling, he was skipping, he was hugging everybody. And one young nurse who just started with us said to the other nurse, oh my God, he came in and he, Dr. Kelly is amazing. The other girl said, I know, have you told him? No, oh God, no. I mean, he already knows. Nobody knows. Okay, guys, nobody knows. We don't tell each other, especially men, how amazing each other we are, because we think that's a sign of weakness. Yeah. It's like, if you're doing a good job and no one's recognizing you, you're probably because they think you know already, but we don't know. And that kind of gets to me every time. Oh, look at Dr. Rob on the TV. Look at his big house and cars, stuff like that. Yeah, I've worked for this and I'm willing to give, we give 20% of our earnings and oh no, 10% of the earnings, 15% from my pocket that we give away to charity every single year. So 150,000 we give away, you know, but nobody says thank you.
Yeah.
Because they think I already know, and we don't. So that kind of pertains to your question. It's like, we've got to start raising these men up again mm-hmm. that are lost.
Yeah. Yeah, that's some. I had a different podcast I was on. I was at college. I played soccer. I still do play soccer now. Actually, my goal eventually, you might see me over there in the UK playing very soon. But
David Beckham's a good friend of mine. I'll just say that. David's a good friend of mine. So if you need anything signed or any you know, I can always kind
yeah, of that would be amazing. Definitely talk to you about that. But I had a coach one time talk to me. He was a college athlete himself. He says, you know, as we get into business, if you were an athlete growing up, you were so used to when you were doing something good on the field or in the arena, the crowd giving you the recognition every time you did something well. And then as you get into the business world and as you graduate and you start going on your own, nobody is there to ever clap your successes, no matter what. So you have to find ways that you can do it for yourself. And a really good one he told me is to create a highlight reel for yourself and make an album in your phone. And whenever you're feeling down, to go through all of these things, because nobody, like you said, is going to tell you.
No, it's the worst feeling in the world. When you can't do it when I come off TV, or if it's a big show, or I spoke on stage with 100,000 people a couple of times, when you come off the down, the mood just drops because you've got no clapping, you've got no cheering, you've got no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I whenever I go in, when I was in Dallas, whenever I went, everybody recognized me. If I go to meetings, they recognize me. Recognized me in the street because I was on a show called Eye Opening, which was a daily national show. And when that stopped and we moved to San Antonio and I walked down the street and nobody said anything, that kind of hurt me. I didn't like that feeling, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I know what you're talking about. It's like I have to start building myself up. And I have a great wife who understands all this. I can be on the side of a stage, say on TV stage, going on to do this amazing show. And all of a sudden, the internal dialogue go, what the hell are you doing here? Nobody wants to listen to you. Mm-hmm. You know, you think you're all that, but you're not. And I start getting nervous and I start shaking. And my wife just leans over and said, you're Dr. Rob fucking Kelly, right? And I go on and do the show. But without her being there, I don't think I could go on. So we all need the adoration or self-adoration in their head.
I'm curious with, you know, people that struggle with addictions, and you're talking about this, like, how important is it to have that type of partner who understands the struggles that you've kind of gone through and who is there to help, you know, give you that other thought that isn't reoccurring in the hypothalamus, who can break that pattern for you in those moments? Because I know so many people that struggle with it, if they have the wrong partner, it actually exacerbates the problem.
100%. We're communicational animals. We need that communication every day. Well, you need four chemicals in your brain every day to be happy, okay? So one of them is endorphins. Get to the gym, you know, do something, exercise, 20 minutes, that's all. Dopamine is a reward system, our pleasure system. You know, go out and compliment three people every day. Dopamine is released into your brain. The serotonin, which is a social belonging, and sunlight, you need, you know, that social belonging. And oxytocin is what we're going to talk about now, which is our bonding, human, cuddling, holding, kissing, all that stuff. It needs to happen every day. So for me, I'm going to stick my neck out here and hope my wife doesn't hear this. I'm only joking. Is I couldn't do this without her. If she, whatever happened, something happened to her tomorrow and she wasn't available or she decided to leave, I would not be able to function. I would close the company down and I'd be done. So for me, it's 100%. I need that stuff because you get to a certain part, and you'll know when you start playing pro soccer, especially in England, you'll get to a certain part where people place you above you. You know, they don't really approach you because you're this, you know, I get it all the time. I go to meetings. I run this meeting Saturday morning. I used to run it. There was 50 people there. And when we finished at the end, nobody walked up and said, good job. Thank you. Shake. Not, they were all in there. All the crowds were talking. I was left on my own. I said to this guy one day, I said, I'm going to stop doing this. He's like, why, Rob? They love it. Nobody comes up to me. Nobody says thank you. Yeah, you're stunned. He looked at me and went, you're famous. Nobody's going to come up to you. And I said, there's no way it was that. When I started going out to them, Brennan, come to speak to me. It's amazing. No one would approach me. And that's what we seem to get out of them. Without that, the four chemicals don't flow. I start going depressed. And then what happens when I get depressed? I go to the doctor and he gives me an SSR for depression. After a few weeks, I start feeling okay again. But when we roll that tape back, I am not getting the serotonin from the social belonging. I didn't need meds all along.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about me personally. I needed to deal with that serotonin break when nobody was coming up to me and speaking to me.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I love that. I'm wondering, do you feel like that there's people that can get with addiction? Somehow people get addicted to toxic relationships.
Oh, yeah.
And why do you feel that people go towards the toxic relationship? And this is as much as me asking for people as it is for someone asking for myself.
People who's had trauma in their life with mom and dad or caregivers, we stay. I'm going to watch your face when I say this, Chris. We stay in relationships far longer than we should. So if you are brought up, let's say, in an alcoholic home or a violent home, my whole being, my trauma, their trauma will come for my trauma, and my whole body, brain, central nervous system reacts to that violence. So what happens is that violence becomes my go-to every time, even though it's damaging. So when I grow up into teens, 20s, 30s, when I attract the nice girl that comes from a nice home, that doesn't last. I can't connect with her. But I get someone who's violent and stuff like that in the house and drinks, I can connect with that. And that's what happens. There was a girl in England, like a 16-year-old, 17-year-old, I can't remember how long, blonde-haired, blue-eyed schoolgirl that was snatched off the side of the streets. And there was a manhunt, huge manhunt in England for her, and they couldn't find her. So they scaled it off. But 9 months later, still haven't found her. But a police officer is in a car traveling down, following this other car, and the indicator didn't work, signal light. So he pulls him over, he's doing a check, checks his car, finds a stolen screwdriver in the car. So now he's allowed to go back to the house by British law back then, search the house for other stolen materials. Sure enough, lawnmowers, weeders, all sorts of stolen stuff they find. Just before they arrested him, they go into this other room, they found this box, 4 foot high by about 12 foot long. And they said, "We know you've got more stolen stuff in there." So they smashed the lock up, opened it, and there was the 17-year-old schoolgirl that had gone missing 9 months before. She was alive. She was taken out daily. She was beaten. She was abused, restroom, food, and back in the box for 9 months. They opened the box. The police officer, the woman, took her hand and helped her step outside the box. She took her coat off, and she wrapped it around this 17-year-old girl. What's the first thing you think she did? She got back in the box.
Yeah.
That's trauma. That's inbred trauma time and time and time again. That's what we do. So our relationship here is all copied from our relationship here. It's all learned behavior. Okay. It's all learned behavior. Now, if you want to have a great life, if you want to, you know, live life to the full, you have to go back and uncover, discover, discard of the trauma that's ruling your life today. And everybody has this, believe it or not. Everybody has it. I had a kid once, he used to live in a $4 million house. He had all sorts of problems. And I took him back to his childhood. He never really seen his mum and dad. He used to have nannies. "Well, how often do you see your dad?" "I saw him on Sunday between 4 and 5. "Why didn't you see him any other time?" "He was away working. Very, very, very famous businessman, you know." It's like, he was abandoned. So when he goes into relationships as an adult, it doesn't feel right until he pisses the girl off that much that she leaves him. And all of a sudden that becomes a comfort zone. And he'll go and try it again and again and again and again. He will sabotage situations as much as he can. So it all ends in disaster. Learned behavior from trauma.
Yeah. Makes total sense, man. One last question, because I know you got to go here soon. For those who are struggling with addiction, who might be afraid to ask for help, are there things that they can do for themselves before they feel like they're ready to ask for help to just get the ball rolling?
Dialogue is the best thing. Whether mom and dad worried about kids or, you know, partners or whatever, start dialogue straight away. It's the first thing you do. If you know you have a problem, and here's it, two indicators. If you take the first drink, can you stop? If you can't, you're in trouble. Alcoholism is the only self-diagnosed illness in the world, okay? So you've got to realize, are you drinking too much? Can you stop? And the other one is, if you say to one of your friends, do you think I'm an alcoholic? There's a good chance you are. So start dialogue. And of course, you can always call us. We're never going to try and sell you anything. We're probably booked up for the next 2 years, I think. But if you're really struggling, guys, and you're in that place where you just don't know what to do, check this out. 214-600-0210 is my personal cell phone. It skips the desk. It skips my secretary, assistant. It comes straight to my phone I'm holding right now. So if it gets that bad, I'd rather have a two-way text conversation with you than hear of your funeral 2 or 3 months down the line. So yeah. In the trenches, always be. I'm the guy that sold his kids out for alcohol. You know, I will always be there for people that are struggling. And if you just want to, you know, a 10-minute chat where it will change your life, text me first. I'll call you up. We'll have 10 minutes. So here's the deal. We have a 10-minute pep talk with you. If it doesn't change your life right there and then, I will send you $100 for your time. It's a win-win situation. You know, it's a win-win situation. And I'm a man of my word as well. And the other thing is, jump on the website, robkelly.com. I spell my name with two B's, robkelly.com. Loads of stuff on there. And there's also a button there that you can come straight through to me as well.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Rob Kelly, man, I appreciate the time that you've spent with us and sharing all this information, man. It's been an amazing conversation and hopefully not the last.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Chris. Have a great day.
Yeah. Talk to you soon. Bye. Until next time, guys. Peace.